Welcome to Inside Seaweed. This is the podcast where we talk about the incredible world of seaweed and how this growing industry is bringing innovation and solutions to address climate change and the environmental crisis. My guest today is a former commercial fisherman who went through a journey of ecological redemption by turning into a regenerative ocean farmer. And he's also the co-founder of a pioneering nonprofit called Green Wave. This is a global network of farmers, entrepreneurs, researchers, all focused on building community-based climate solutions out at sea through collaboration and innovation. His name is Brent Smith. His story is truly fascinating and inspiring. I'm not even going to try to summarize it. I wouldn't do it justice. But that's okay, because he's done it brilliantly through his incredible book titled Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. What's coming next is my conversation with Brent. I really hope you'll enjoy it. Here it goes. Brent, it is an unbelievable honor to have you here today. Welcome to Inside Seaweed.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is really fun. It's pretty exciting that there's seaweed-specific podcasts and even like Looking Behind the Veil podcasts of seaweed. So it's fun to be here.
Seaweed nerds.
Yeah.
I'd like to start with food. Like, you know, why not? Like, all the best conversations start. Kelp fra diavolo. It's a recipe you talk about in your book, Eat Like a Fish, which, by the way, I loved. I would really recommend. What is special for you about this recipe?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, a lot's changed since I wrote the book, and a lot's changed in the world too, right? And this sort of, there was a trajectory that I went on, not me, but with, you know, folks we work with partners, with chefs, on how do you make kelp specifically delicious, because it's not, right? Like, and we have to be honest about that. But what's amazing is that we're at this culinary moment that where chefs and all sorts of entrepreneurs and stuff kind of specialize in making gross things delicious, right? You know, they specialize in climate cuisine, right? Because we can't just eat what we want anymore, what tastes good. We need to eat what the planet will provide and what we can do in a sustainable, regenerative way. And so we need the creativity of the chefs to really make it delicious, or else we're just going to be eating, you know, force-fed, disgusting stuff while we save the climate. And that would suck, right? You know? Yeah. So the trajectory was really, we just tried all these sort of things. And there was us, and there was Ocean Approved, which became Atlantic Sea Farms, and all of us were just trying to figure out that flavor profile. And what we found was, instead of just having kelp be the center of the plate, you know, sort of bringing the flavor down, making it milder through blanching, and just bring out all the great qualities of kelp. So, you know, that umami taste, the good mouthfeel. And mm-hmm. What we found is, like, is not have it be kelp forward, have it be noodle forward. So the fra diavolo, where we had the kelp noodles with tomato sauce, onions, just, you know, pretty simple, garlic, a little bit of anchovies, things like that. And people just wouldn't even think of it as seaweed, right? They just think of it as delicious, find out it was seaweed, and then already be bought in. But the most interesting piece of it was, like, yeah, we did, you know, high-end events in New York. We were doing things with, like, you know, Rene Redzepi was out on the farm and cooking with it, and David Chang and all these folks. But when we started serving it at, like, to just regular folks like plumbers and fishermen and stuff, they loved it too. And so that, you know, crossing the class boundary, I think, was really important. So, but here's the thing, like, I really screwed up early on in that calling kelp the new kale. As you know, as I look back, and the reason we called kelp the new kale, when we came up with that, it was just, I had some Yale, students out there that were working on the Yale farm, and they all had those kale shirts on that were big for a while.
Yeah.
And as a joke, we crossed it out with a marker and wrote kelp, right? Mm-hmm. So kelp is the new kale. And that was supposed to be the trajectory, to normalize it like kale. But kelp is not like kale. It's like I think it's a more powerful crop in terms of economically and environmentally, but it's not like we're going to make it standalone center of the plate, right? We need to think of kelp as a as an ingredient of combining with other flavors. And that's why, like, you move from kelp as the new kale to kelp in the plant-based diet of a company like Akua that's doing mushroom and kelp-based burgers, right? So let's, like, blend land and sea flavors. And I think that's where it begins to really, really change when we shift into ingredients. There's some real challenges with that. But, and then move down the plant. So that whole light leaf strategy, so specialty products, plant-based products, and then we move into like biostimulants and things like that. And, you know, you don't do that with kale. That's not the trajectory of it. So I like, you know, I need to forgive myself of sending it on the wrong track.
you know, at the end of the day, it's about shifting people's perception, isn't it? And you talk a lot about asking the ocean what we need to grow rather than asking the market what we need to sell, you know, moving away from the tuna and the salmon and going more into these sort of sea greens. Since it's a matter of perception and emotions, even as humans, we're very receptive to stories. And so it's just not going to be enough to tell people, well, you have to do this because it's good for you, because it's good for the planet. What is the story that is going to move people and allow us to say, okay, we're going to say goodbye to the old way and create a new one, and this is why?
Yeah. And I think it's a great question. Honestly, you know, I don't know the answer. That's the journey sort of all of us in the climate sector is are thinking, like, do we scare people or do we give solutions or do we, like, how do we just talk about this new, what's our story for the new era, right? And I think we're all searching for it. I do know that when people, we're at the, it's the end of the age of decadence. So it's no longer, like, the more kelp that's sold at the highest end restaurants in the urban centers means this is not going the right direction, right? To my mind, right? Like, with that era is over and the end of decadence. And I don't think people want to be told what to eat anymore, sort of shamed into eating this stuff. So we don't want to do that. What we found that tapping into sort of this sector as a way to provide meaning, to have like soul filling jobs has been a really important piece. I mean, you know, Green Wave started as a very small organization, just training a handful of people. And then our waiting list for a training program just in the US grew to 8,000 people, right?
Wow.
And the question is, you know, why? And then in 100 countries on top of that. And again, we're a little small nonprofit. And I think it's because this sector felt possible. Like, you can be a regular person like me, start a farm, produce something concrete, like that you can hold, you growing things is a beautiful activity to spend your life doing, and be part of the, you know, climate movement, the solutions movement. So not the food movement, not the environmental movement, but that big tent of climate, of jobs, of justice, of new blue economy, of food, like that whole, of racial justice, this whole mix of things. And I think that's really moved a lot of lot of hearts and minds over the day. I think, you know, there's a story that Rita Cobb tells in Newfoundland. And, you know, I'm from Newfoundland originally. And she talks about her father coming home one day. He's a fisherman his whole life. And he says, you know, they just turned fish into money. And what he meant by that, you know, he's a small businessman. You're a fisherman. You want to make money. Like, you're not a, like, some liberal non-profity person, right? But what he's saying is, like, the big industrial fleets turned fish from food and something that has social value into a pure raw commodity.
Yeah.
And so he actually burned his boat that day.
Wow. Radical.
Like, it's like a famous moment in Newfoundland history. And I don't think we want to turn kelp into just money, right? We want to retain the soul-filling jobs, people having meaning, being on their boats, having self-directed lives, like, not just automating the whole system. I think we've got to, you know, make sure that regular people can enter the industry, have part in, like, go to work every single morning trying to figure out how to solve the climate crisis in their own way. Like, inventing a, you know, going on your boat and try to figure out how to turn it into a kelp tractor. Like, you want that blue-collar innovation. And, like, we have to reorganize this economy. If what we do with seaweed is just recreate what we did in the 20th century, that'll have been a failure. Like, there's no way we're going to get climate policy without addressing inequality, right? Because so many people in society, if all we do is draw down carbon and we don't lift up communities, the politics is going to be like, just let it burn, right? I mean, like, we don't want, right? Let the planet burn if you're just going to solve the solutions for the wealthy and rest everyone else is just, you know, in true pain and suffering. So I think this we're at this incredible moment with seaweed where we could reimagine, build something beautiful that we're proud of, that's a huge tent that changes the politics, right? You know, and like changes the incentives and why people are sort of directing their lives in this sector, or we can just do vertically integrated sort of, you know, sort of boring business models, right? You know, and it, for me, for many of us that are in, that's not an interesting set of problems, right? Interesting set of problems is how to solve economic insecurity and inequality along with the climate crisis. Again, draw down that carbon while you're lifting up communities.
Yeah, you said earlier about the importance of doing it your own way. How much do you think it's a matter of agency to draw in people?
Yeah, so I mean, there is just this question of like, why have people come to seaweed? It's just, it's odd. Like the number of women in the sector, in the ocean sector, is just stunning, right? For all these people from different walks of life, like young land-based farmers, fishermen, shell fishermen, you know, retired cops and lawyers, investment bankers, like it's a bloody mess of who's, you know, who wants to do this. And that's a beautiful thing. And I do think it's like, because it's seen as something that we can build from the bottom up, it opens up this feeling of agency. You don't got to go work in a cubicle at Facebook. You can actually be an actor in the world, tap in your agency. And I think if I look back over the last sort of, you know, one of the real challenges of the economy is we all feel like cogs and we don't feel like we can make a difference. We feel helpless in the climate crisis and you have to be a big CEO to do it, right?
That's it.
You got to be a Bezos or something like that.
Yeah.
And we don't, like, we can be, you know, see, we're just a small piece of the puzzle of the crisis. It's not like the panacea to everything. God, it's great to go to work every day trying to play a role in that.
GreenWave, you founded it as a nonprofit aiming to train and support ocean farmers. What made you decide to set up GreenWave as a nonprofit? And I'm really keen to understand what made you adopt this sort of open source philosophy.
So I've been farming the same patch for 20 years out here in Long Island Sound, right? And I started as an oysterman, you know, I think you know from history, it was like I was a terrible oysterman. Like I had no idea how to, I was the worst farmer on earth, right? You know, just killing things, running a death camp. But then over time, you know, years and years just stuck with it. And so was able to grow it. And I, you know, doing oysters and then it was the diversification was kind of easy, like bringing seaweed in for me was easy because I had a market because I was right next to New York City and I had entree into all the high-end restaurants and stuff like that. So like my model was fine and like that, you know, like was doing very well. And I had a choice as sort of seaweed gained in popularity very, very early on, sort of got a lot of traction, was to, you know, sort of create a big business. And I just decided for myself, there was sort of two things. One was just personal, like what I wanted on my deathbed, I would love for the 30,000 people that were thrown out of work in Newfoundland when the cod fishery died to have jobs and jobs on their boats, jobs with meanings and with meaning and, you know, that sort of jobs they can sing songs about. Like that'll be a beautiful moment. It's not that I'm a millionaire. It's great for people to make a lot of money. It's just not an interesting problem for me personally to solve, right? So that was like, I said, no, I don't want to go that direction. But what we have to do is replicate. Like we need a lot more farms. Like this wasn't about me. This was about getting as much seaweed in the water. And so the idea of GreenWave was that there needed to be early on a non-competitive, like a pre-competitive actor.
Yeah.
Right? So where there wasn't the financial incentives to build walls, right? To protect your, you know, protect IP and keep things secret, that the industry was going to fail if we all weren't sharing. And even if it didn't fail, it was going to replicate and grow very slowly. Going to spend 20 years in like everybody making the same mistakes, right? So the idea was, okay, let's create a nonprofit that was like a safe space where people could share, and so we could have a hive mind. Because I can't, especially on the farmer side, I cannot stress enough how hard it is to grow food underwater. It's like the stupidest place to grow food, right? I mean, you can't control your soil, right? It turns over 1,000 times a day. You're at the whims of the ocean. You can't see your crops. I mean, it's like Mars and under the ocean are like the craziest place to grow. Need to, because, you know, our food systems are being pushed out to sea and all the nutrients are in the ocean. There's a soil crisis on land, all those reasons. Like, we have to. But the only way you're going to deal with that volatility and the difficulty growing the ocean is through like a network, like very strong networks of collaboration and sharing. You know, what I think of as that hive mind. And it's amazing. Green Wave at the recent Seagriculture conference, you know, we brought farms from around the country to that conference and did farmer only meetings and as well as farmer panels and stuff, and lifted up and allowed farmers to sort of speak for themselves and to meet together. And it's incredible what came out of that. We just created a space. There are farmers now traveling this fall from Maine down to Long Island to help folks set anchors. There are another farmer is tripling the size of their farm and working with another farm on co-packing. There are farmers from Alaska that are interested in going to visit farms in Europe, right? Like, that's what you want, right? And that'll allow us to replicate really fast and replicate quickly. Really hoping that when we hit 10,000 farmers, the idea is to move on to other stuff. So that's like the theory behind it. The programming at Green Wave, so what we've been able to do over time is narrow our focus. Because early on, when there weren't so many people involved, like, we had to have our fingers in everything, and it just meant that a bunch of the stuff we weren't good at, right? You know what I mean? So we've really narrowed our focus, and we've got this a sort of strategy to scale, because we really need to scale the industry. And one is the hub, right? The Regenerative Ocean Farming Hub, which I really encourage people to go on and log into and explore. And on there is a curriculum with like 80 videos, how-tos, and like, we're going to be adding new species, things like that. That's that 8,000 people that have just want to explore and think about this. So there's that piece. And then there's a community. And the community has been fascinating, where we have paid farmer mentors on there that answer questions. So these are folks that are experienced farmers. There are 351 topics that have been that have just populated by people. There are 130 active farmers, 180 farmers that have permits, 68 hatcheries on there. And all these people, they're like arguing about anchors, right? That's exactly what we want, right? At the same time, there are 2,500 people that have sort of are on the hub doing the curriculum in the community. We're getting a couple hundred signups every month. And that's just in
That's impressive, yeah.
That's amazing. So we built it. We didn't know if anybody would use it, and they're really, really using it, which is amazing. So that's the curriculum and community. And then we have the Seaweed Source. And the Seaweed Source started as sort of a very simple buyer's network. We just took one farm and tried to sell all their crops. And then we're able to do that. Then we expanded it to five or six farms. And now we've moved the thing online, which is essentially a seaweed exchange almost, right? Where buyers come in, they have to almost like apply to come in, so that we know that they're actually buying seaweed. They're buying the type of seaweed that folks actually grow, and that they're willing to pay a decent price, right? So they've got to apply to come in there. And we got about, I think, 15 or 16 companies as buyers in the Seaweed Source right now. That's great. Like, here on the East Coast, that's excellent. And then just about 20 farms, and that's throughout New England and New York. And now we've been asked by farmers to expand it to Alaska and elsewhere. So that sort of exchange has been really important. There's like map tools, and there's like all sorts of stuff in there. So that's like the hub. And then the other piece is the Kelp Climate Fund.
Okay.
there's the whole blue carbon question. That's how we got to this final place, the Kelp Climate Fund. The Kelp Climate Fund, in its core, is really simple, which is you get, as a farmer, it's open to any farmer in the U.S. right now. It's first come, first serve. It's a little over a $300,000 a year fund, right? Where you get paid $1 a foot to plant kelp, straight subsidy, and you're getting that because you're providing environmental and climate benefits. With that, and there are 30 farmers from around the country in that. It started as a beta, just a couple farms, 30 farmers, $300,000 fund this year. And in return, there's something that is the MyKelp app. It used to enter some data. They collect data once a month so that to track yields and quality and things like that. And, you know, it's private data and anonymous and stuff like that. But it is an incredibly powerful data set of farms all across the country collecting data in exactly the same way. They're all trained in exactly the same way, given the same tools. App goes in. It's a mix of images and actual physical measurements, and that's just going to – it's a pretty amazing thing.
I wanted to sort of riff on that for a bit, because one of the themes in your book that really caught my attention and that made me stop and think about it was this idea that with the use of kelp fertilizer, we can – I'm going to quote – build a bridge between land and sea in order to close the loop between our food systems. What do you mean by that?
People have been using kelp as a fertilizer for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, right? All over the world, all different societies, different. It's established that, like, farmers on land know that there is stuff in kelp that is of value to soil and plants. So nothing new here. But I was at this conference of regenerative agriculture at Al Gore's ranch, right? And it was like 300 people, and I didn't know anybody, and I was, you know, like, I was hiding in the corner. I was the only OSIN person there, and the whole thing. And everybody starts, one of the main takeaways was, like, everybody's raising their hand in panels talking about the soil crisis, the nutrient crisis. And they're like, not enough nutrient.
Really?
But we don't want to use fertilizer. And I was like, well, it's all in the ocean. You know, nitrogen, carbon, phosphorus and stuff is all in the ocean. I said, we can use kelp to soak that up and sell it back to you. We're totally up for that, right? It's just obvious that, like, water, all this stuff runs into the ocean. Let's collect it and get it back to the soil like people have been doing hundreds of years. It's just time to do it because there is a nutrient crisis on land. So this opens up markets and opportunities. Now, so that's one piece. The other thing is, as folks dig into this, like, I think the way we can have the fastest climate impact is to take what's in seaweed of different varieties and weave it into the agricultural sector, right? So reduce the impact of the give land-based farmers some really powerful tools to reduce their impact, because we can do it really fast. We don't have to invent new things.
They know it already.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, New Zealand is way ahead on this. And like, Iceland and stuff, the wild harvesters have been doing this for a long, long time. But it's going deeper than that. So there is some really amazing evidence that research that's come out that if you take kelp and turn it into a biostimulant,
okay,
so not as a fertilizer, but you extract certain pieces of it, and you put it on plant roots – It makes them more tolerant to water and heat stress. Now, that proves to be true. The science says it, but if it's scalable, that is a stunning thing that we can use seaweeds in order to make make more resilient land-based farms. Like, that's revolutionary if that can happen. The unit economics of that are that's a huge challenge. But we do know seaweeds have these incredible uses in land-based crops, you know, and as well as the methane in animals and stuff like that. But I'm fascinated by what specifically kelp does to the root systems of vegetables. I think that's the sort of next frontier.
Do you think there may be room for small entrepreneurs and producers of fertilizers or biostimulants to be a part of the puzzle? So going back to, you know, people coming in as individuals, or do you think is going to be dominated by a few big fertilizer companies?
Yeah. And this is the big looming question. I mean, you know, all of society's got to figure out what they want their world to look like. Like, there is a chance in the climate change to reorder the chessboard. And so that's one thing. Like, and I don't think we have our, as a, I know in the US, we do not have our act together enough or the culture in order to do that. Like, just hands down, not going to happen, right? But, and that's heartbreaking. But what I think is, and this is way above my pay grade, like, I'm not smart enough to think about this stuff, but I, you know, I don't know what scale looks like in the ocean. Like, you know, on land, a 500 acre farm is a small family farm in Iowa, right? And 500 acres of seaweed is an incredible amount of seaweed, right? So we don't know, first of all, what scale looks like. Everybody's like, oh, small scale, 5, 6, 20 acres. You know, when you get up to 300, you have to be a big company. I just don't buy into it. Like, and also, we have farmer, like, not we, there are no such thing as a green wave farmer. Let me say that. We, relationships with farmers that are growing, like, you know, 300,000 pounds in 5 acres. Okay. Like, that has to do with intensity, right? So anyway, there's this big question of scale, but the key question here to me is vertical integration. Are the same companies going to own, is it going to be a Monsanto, right? Like, where, or a Cargill?
Yes, that's just where I was going with it. Yeah.
That owns the seed, owns the silo infrastructure on the farm and the market, but doesn't own the farm because that's the riskiest part of the economic model, right? You know, like that, that's actually what ag looks like. And personally, like, there will be companies that do that, and I think that might be fine. I don't know, right? You know, but what we care about is that there's another track where it's horizontally integrated, not vertically integrated, so that there's real community benefits. The reason I say this sort of horizontal versus vertical is such a confusing space to me is, like, we got to get more kelp in the water, period. Like we got to feed more people. We need more secondary products that help. We got to capture that carbon, stuff like that. And I don't know the model that's going to do that most effectively. I do really question the assumption that it has to be vertically integrated or that you can get the most volume in vertical integration. So I don't know if I'm explaining this clearly enough, but, like, I have two farming sites because one sometimes doesn't do well. Sometimes the other one does. Like, if I were a buyer, I would want to be buying from 50 different sites, from 50 different hatcheries, because it distributes my risk in order to get consistent volume, right? It is hard to grow food underwater. Like, and so I'm not sure scale gives that vertical integration gives the protection that's needed to a company to be profitable. That's
In terms of resilience.
Resilience, because it's going to be a hellish 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You're going to, like, and I mean, our climate resilience strategy is non-complexity. Like, the reason we're not designing more and more complex farms is the way you're going to get through the next 50 years is just use ropes and buoys and anchors so that when it gets wiped out, you can rebuild in 3 weeks. Right? That's a business model, I think, that actually is. So anyway, so, like, I really question people's assumptions about scale. But that said, right now, like, you know, the price of kelp ranges from $1.50 a pound down to 6 cents a pound. Okay? And the farmers, what's interesting, look at the industry, there's all this energy on, like, policy, science, and entrepreneur sort of secondary process value development. There is very little energy on the or money in the farming side because investors are saying there's no money in farming. But there's no money in farming, there's no supply. Right? Yeah. But I'm being told again and again, like, yeah, we don't want to do farming because there's no money to be had in that. So for us at Greenwave, what we're working on is, okay, let's not think of the farm as just the farm growing the kelp itself, but the farm should own the nursery, which is like a shipping container that can produce 12 miles of seed in 20 foot container. You know? So you own that, you own the farm, and you own this, you own first stage processing, so stabilization, So you're creating like a almost like a kelp slurry or a stabilized product that you can sell over 8 months to the buyers that are doing the plastics and the burgers and all and the fertilizers and stuff like that. In order to get the right price, farmers have to have that chunk. Now, no one knows how to stabilize kelp at an affordable price that allows farmers to make enough money to keep farming. That does not exist, like no matter what anybody says. Because they know how to do it, some of the different companies, but they don't know how to do it to make the unit economics right. So that's not doing it. That's bench scale. That's like a sign, you know what I mean? Like,
Not
whether you create bioplastic or you can create a pig feed or something like that. It's can you make the system, the economics work of the system? That's the question. And no one's done it.
I wanted to ask about tobacco bans in that sense.
Yeah.
If you're happy to.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, we hear a lot about this primary processing piece and how it's a huge challenge and that we need to stabilize seaweed very quickly and needs to be in an energy efficient way, because otherwise what's the point? And like you said, then the economics behind it don't work. And I heard you talk about tobacco bans. And so I want to ask you, first of all, how have you come across tobacco bans, and have they provided an answer to this issue, at least in your experience?
Yeah. Let me start by saying, God, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. Right?
And we all.
But the only thing I've done is freaking stuck with it. Right. You know, I think it's as we turn from a community of passion into a community of practice, it's time to really expose and really talk openly about the mistakes we've made across like all of us. And I think we really need to reset the culture. So it's not fake it till you make it. Right. Sort of a Silicon Valley thing of like pitch and bring in new investment or costs. And then like, you know, you hope it comes together, but you're hiding the ball, right? To like, listen, this piece isn't working. Let's to create a cohort together to solve this stabilization issue, to solve the issue that the entire industry across the world is based on wild seed collection, right? Like there are some major questions that we need to talk about in front. So anyway, I say that because the tobacco barns was like so exciting and awesome. COVID hits, we can't process. Sam Garwin on our team starts trying to figure this out. Like, what are we going to do? Turns out Connecticut, of all places, there was a tobacco industry here. He finds a tobacco family that's been around since the 1600s drying tobacco, right? We bring the kelp there. They have all the barns, but they don't do tobacco anymore. And they've been trying to do flowers and stuff like that. And we bring the kelp. And everybody's like, God, kelp really looks like tobacco leaves. And we hang it up, and the barns work perfectly, the right aeration, everything like that. We got ground to a halt because the state said it's not food safe.
Seriously.
Which is fascinating because the wild harvest industry all dries outside. So as farmers, we're not allowed, those of us to grow it, not allowed to dry outside, which is the sun is a very cheap way to dry kelp, but it shows how the health behind the curve a lot of the policy is to where it needs to be. So we stop that completely, which is too bad because there's a lot of tobacco barns. Now, I think through that journey and through that not working has come out, I think, some really great things. I mean, like there's for stabilization, that first stage processing, there is fermentation, right? Throw some stuff in, you can hold it, but it's like a blunt tool, right? You know what I mean? Like you get some basic, very useful stuff, and you can hold it, sort of kelp slurry.
Is that okay for fertilizers?
Yeah, like feed especially and fertilizer, but not biostimulant.
Okay.
Not biostimulant.
Okay.
Again, everything I say has to do with the unit economics. So people can do it, but they're like enzymes that they're putting in are so expensive that the system doesn't work. So it's still bench scale. They're trying to drive down the cost of that. So there's fermentation. Then there's like drying and dehydration. The big machines are way too expensive, as we know. There are some examples of where it can be done with really strong sources of alternative energy, like in Europe, but that's not replicable because the alternative energy sector is a mess, right? You know, there is no consistent grid. So we need to figure out a way to dry to and a much cheaper way. And the way to do that is there are microwave machines that dry, right? That's like that's looking like what it's going to be. And then there's serious green chemistry, or not green chemistry, toxic chemistry too, where folks throw in stuff, blow those cells apart, and it's extremely expensive. Tons of R&D. They will figure it out, but again, the unit economics aren't there yet. So those are, in my head, those are sort of the three categories of how we, different versions of way to sterilize. GreenWave is working right now. We just put the last year, we've been working intensely on combining with partners to create modular hatcheries that can produce for like $80,000. You can build out of the box a hatchery that looks exactly the same, that produces high quality seed and can be run by one person. That's what ours is now, right? So they're like, there's that. And the dependence on wild seed through work, gametophyte work, there's that. And then this stabilization piece of finding the right partners to really solve that. And we're bringing together some different value-added producers, you know, the folks that are doing the secondary processing who don't want to do stabilization, to figure out how do we do dockside. So the kelp comes in, there's a unit there that gets it, creates a kelp slurry that then multiple different buyers can use in different industries.
Could a modular sort of like shipping container type unit, could that work in your mind? Something that is mobile, that is sort of shipping container or back of a truck kind of situation where you can transport it to wherever is needed.
Yeah.
Is that something that you see a need for, or that could be a solution?
We could do it now in the hatcheries, like out of the, not mobile, but like out of the box, drop a shipping container, fully functional. Like we can, that can be done.
For the hatchery.
Yeah, on the hatchery. The processing is, folks, that is necessary. I think that's the only model that's going to work. I don't think folks really know how to do it. Like we need to come together to figure out how to do it at an economic way. You know, like folks can kind of do it, but they can't provide it in a consistent, stable setting that the buyers want. But I think it's the only way, dockside, because in a lot of places, either the farms are too far away from the processing facilities, like physically, or the working waterfront is pretty much non-existent. Right, it's been bought up by wealthy tourists and stuff like that. So really, that is, I think, the from my farmer perspective, and like, yeah, honestly, like everything I'm saying, like ignore, like what like I'm decent at growing some kelp, right? But this is just sort of the way as we're trying to feel our way in the dark in these things. That this quest, the two questions of ending the collection of wild seed and dockside stabilization are the two things that have to be solved, but. Like the dockside stabilization, there's not massive money in that, right? For an investor, right? So all the investment money is going into that second stage, you know, value-added bioplastic stuff like that, which is really important. But like this low margin, extremely boring step of just creating a kelp slurry, there just isn't the activity. And then this example in the industry of where like, I think we need to think about the capital stack, like what kind of money and where it goes strategically all at the same time. Because like if the buyers can't get a kelp slurry to quality they want and consistency, you know, they're not going to be able to, you know, show their investors any, you know, any return at all. If we don't scale up the farms and farmers aren't making a living, then there's not going to be no kelp slurry, and there's not going to be, you know what I mean? Like everybody's got to come together and think about these pieces in combination.
Absolutely. I just want to quickly go back to the concept of credits. We talked about blue carbon. We're sort of hinting at blue nutrients potentially. So I wanted to, if you don't mind, maybe introduce the concept of pollution farming.
Yeah.
Which I think it would be really interesting in particular, you know, in terms of the business model.
Yeah. So let me come at it from the blue carbon journey we've been on. So when I was at Oysters, it was all nitrogen collection and trying to create markets around that. And then it moved in with seaweed, it moved into blue carbon. I mean, if I had a nickel every time someone came to call me about blue carbon, I'd be a millionaire. We've come to the conclusion, we partnered with people around accreditation, a bunch of scientific projects, stuff like that. My frustration grew and I was like, okay, like, first of all, the trouble with blue carbon is it's called blue carbon. Like kelp Its power is its bundle of climate benefits: phosphorus, nitrogen, carbon, reef restoration, like, you know, a soil amendment. It's like jobs. Like, that is the power of it. So we call it carbon. It's too narrow a focus. And I'm not even sure kelp's most powerful remediation, its largest power is carbon. I think it's actually other things. Like, you get kelp into soil and you reduce, what it does is it stabilizes nitrous oxide, which is 300 times more potent than carbon as a greenhouse gas. Like, but that doesn't fit into like blue carbon, right? So that was the first thing, was like it's a bundle of benefits. The second thing, I was like, listen, the markets are too slow. Like, everybody's like, markets are like, what's the goal here of blue carbon in this, is to get more kelp in the water. Like, the policy's too slow, the pricing's too low, the science is slow, policy slow, and the market development is slow. And I don't know, I just, like, we don't have time. We've got 9 years and the planet's going to end, and they're going to be trying to figure out, like, still talking about talking about it. And so we switched, and we're like, okay, no, straight subsidy. Like, we know kelp does good shit. Like, we're positive it does good stuff. Like, the science shows that.
Yeah.
We will learn more and more about what's the good stuff it does. Let's just straight out pay farmers for knowing it has an environmental benefit and have a subsidy. Then when the markets get to finally figure themselves out and it becomes a non-speculative industry, then we can then we'll stop the subsidy, right? But people forget that the goal of blue carbon is to get more kelp in the water, and it's too slow. All the money's going into highly speculative activities that are going to take 10 years of R&D to figure out their blue carbon strategy. And but instead we got, you know, 30 farms planting more kelp and scaling in 1 year just by like dollar a foot. So, I mean, sometimes it helps being a simpleton, right?
So you think trying to replicate the blue carbon model with a blue nitrogen or a blue nutrient certified type credits to take the nutrients from the ocean, get them into depleted soil on regenerative land-based farms, you don't see that as happening fast enough?
Yes, like, it has to happen. I believe in it. It's an important part of the strategy. Mm. It's just, I've been in 20 years about people talking about me about nutrient credits, right?
And it just doesn't.
And I just haven't seen it happen. I'm just getting old, right? So, like, I mean, like, we're 50, like, a couple months ago, and I was like, wait a second, like, 20 years people have been talking to me about trading on oysters and kelp and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't see more kelp going in the water with this. And so we just reorganized GreenWave and took a bunch of our funding, and it goes straight to the farmers, and it allows them to scale, right? Because they know that there's going to be, they're going to get paid the fund. Now, I don't know how long we're going to be able to keep this fund going, right? A global recession coming. We're going to try as long as, so all the farmers know, like, we raise for each year, this is the amount of the money that's in, we'll spend it all the way down. And like, every, you know, so I, you know, we'll try our best to keep it going, but I do think it's the right, for now, it's the right strategy. And I really hope that the science comes together and the policy and the businesses that are being built around blue carbon, do their job well, right? I hope they're competent.
There's that sense of urgency, isn't there?
Yeah.
That, you know, it needs to happen now.
Exactly. I mean, I think the business sector is honestly in climate denial. We think of it's only like a Trump thing, climate denial. It's not. Like, if you're using 20th century business models where you're expecting a 15x return in 6 years, and all the benefits are going to a couple white guys at the top, like that's climate denial, right? It's just not going to work. While saving the planet somehow, right? I just don't trust it, right? And I think they need to invent climate resilient and climate resilient business models out of the, you know, business schools, and get over this sort of hangover of the like, a successful business has to look like this kind of return, this kind of investment. I mean, the capital stack is a mess. Like, farmers don't need investment, they need loans, right? And they need loans that are forgivable loans or low interest or get paid back when the farmer starts making money, or like, but everybody wants to it's a straight equity model. What happens if equity isn't the right way? What happens if it's subsidies, equity, loans, profit sharing? Like, let's get creative with that capital stack, right? Instead of just sort of the same things we did that killed the planet, right?
I feel like we share a frustration here in terms of what you've previously sort of tracked back to what can be described as the Wall Street framework of the unicorn. Could you explain that and what it means for you and how you've come across it, when you've come across it?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think there's a pitch culture that, you know, like, okay, 5-minute pitch, stand out, and that gets the money, right? And honestly, like, I'm pretty good at that. Right? You know, like I can shrink things down, make a couple points. It's like, but what that means is like the boring stuff gets forgotten. And the system doesn't work with like boring stuff, like food logistics, like stabilization. And this isn't me, like I'm not whining or complaining. Like there is so much money in the seaweed sector now. Like there, it's not even like, oh, I wish we were getting more. It's not like that. It's like, I just want the sector to constantly like dig into the real problems that are being faced and have clear eyed in order to all get where we need to go. But this pitch culture of Silicon Valley, of fake it till you make it, like, because you do an investment round by telling like the strongest story that you're going to revolutionize the world. And then you burn through that money. And then you go through another investment round where you tell an even bigger story, right? Without talking about the struggles you're having and what happened when you burn through that first set of cash, right? So your story has to get more ambitious and bigger and show bigger growth and global and things like that. And like, we gotta just like, I don't think that's a healthy thing. Like, we need to go to investors and be like, these pieces aren't working. And we're learning this. And if you want to solve climate change, like, let's dig into these things that are capital intensive, low margin, and boring.
What do you see as those pieces? Well, I mean, we mentioned primary processing.
Primary processing, I think, really ending the dependence on wild seed. I think really making, ramping up production on the farms so that farmers are profitable. I think so you can see all those things. It's an infrastructure need, right? So there's tons of work being done. And like these, I love these folks. They're friends. They're doing amazing work on the secondary, creating. I would never drink it, but I just heard there was some kelp coffee that's coming out. Like it sounds like I don't amazing, right? I was just shown last night, came like Nopla, someone just brought a box of their stuff where they had like olive oil and these little squeezy things that you could eat. They had like wrappers and there were all these things laid out on the table for me. I was like, this is amazing. But, and that has to happen, but they can't get supply at any scale at any unit economics that work, right? And so That's the boring stuff. But the trouble is there's not an incredible money to be made in those boring, solving those boring problems. And I don't know how to do that, but I think the investment community really needs to sort of come together. And that's why, to me, one of the stages I'd love to see GreenWave do is to bring together cohorts of farmers and cohorts of hatchery people, right? Let's bring together cohort of secondary processors to create standards and the technology needed for the farmers to do that first stage processing. That's like the next stage of the industry. And I hope whether it's GreenWave or not or somebody else, I think that's going to be key.
How do you feel about this next stage of the industry?
You know, like we need all hands on deck. I'm just so excited where the industry is going and what's happening and all these brilliant people into the sector. And I think this is an opportunity to now take this to the next level.
We talk a lot about low barrier to entry, individuals being able to play a role. In your mind, other than becoming a seaweed farmer, what could an individual do to be part of this movement with a small initial investment, say $20,000, and a sort of similarly entrepreneurial free agent type fashion?
Absolutely. The hatcheries are an incredible entry point for folks. So like getting together a couple folks, pooling a little money, building a hatchery, that infrastructure on land, because you don't need ocean skills, I think is a, like we have folks coming out of community college and stuff doing like working the hatchery. So I think that's a huge opportunity, taking out a loan and go ahead and setting it up. And there's a lot of demand for seed right now and not enough seed in the market. So that's really good. This energy in terms of value-added products, I just really want to see that going. There's just so much creative and young folks just like spinning out all different things with kelp. I think the policy realm, if you're like an undergraduate thinking about going to graduate school, like let's imagine what the new marine park of the future is, where you have 2,000 acres and you have farmers doing reforestation farming. You've got sustainable fisheries and ecotourism. Like that's the future, but we need people to take that on and build it and figure out the policy and push the politics on that. I think folks that are coming out of the finance sector are really starting to get creative about like what those capital stacks are. And you know, like if you're a regular person like me, I wish someone would build me a tractor of the sea.
Okay.
Like I will get it like that, right? There are so many pieces, like, you know, build something of like how to wind string for hatcheries automatically, figure out how to power the boats, the small boats, you know, with a mix of solar, wind, and electric, right? You know, like there are all these things where we can opportunities, because I hire metal workers, electricians, permitting people, like there's a whole, like folks to paint boats, like they're like all those marine industries with kelp farming, they get revived and there's opportunity, like good working class things. I will say, I think it's crazy that we think about seaweed as this sort of organic thing that should just happen on its own, like in a mess. Like why in wind farms do we have an industrial policy where money comes in, revitalizes a waterfront, permitting happens at once, the capital is lined up, the workers or steel workers are getting trained, you know, like electric boats are being created. Like we need to think about seaweed and like a wind farm strategy, not a like artisanal, cute, like random
cottage industry.
I think that's what like the whole industry needs to come together and be like, no, we're like wind farms. We're not like, you know, little kale farms in the Hudson Valley.
Okay, let's take that away and have a think about it. For everybody listening, you can find links to everything we've discussed, websites, tools, books, in the show notes or on the episodes page on insideseaweed.com. So this is it for now. I've been really looking forward to this chat and I'm grateful to Bren and his team for making it happen. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, take care.